And welcome to Super Respectable. My name is David Lewis, and reporting from our newly opened Tokyo office, Toshio Raman. Tosh, how's it going?
I'm good. If I kind of go like this with my head, it's like, is it going to be Toshio?
No, it's Tokyo. But your name is Japanese.
That's
is
true. That right? That's true. I was born and lived in Japan for 2 years. My parents were there for seven. So
in Tokyo?
No. They were in a small little city outside of Osaka. It's called Yokkaichi. It's where the Honda factory is. That's where my dad worked. Japan has a place in our hearts. My parents speak the language fluently, which is very cool.
Really?
They do. I once saw my mom speaking two languages with two different types of people, one being Japanese, the other being Bengali, on a subway in Austria at the same time, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
That is very cosmopolitan.
My parents speak it when they don't want us to understand what they're saying. But Japan has a place in our hearts, so it's not my citizenship, but it's there, and it's in my name.
And you haven't been back since you left as a child.
It's very true. I haven't been back in 34 years. So I would love to take my little one and my wife and go visit one day when it's safe to. Have you been?
Nope. It's on the list for sure. It's definitely a very cool and intriguing place that it's very much top of the list once it's safe to do so.
Sure. My sister and my brother-in-law are going for their honeymoon, or hopefully next year. That's their, I think they're into the culture. Was very cool. I'd like to go for mostly sushi. That's pretty much all. And see some of the places, but it's one of those places that definitely is I have a lot of interest in, and I'd love to check it out, and I'm excited to watch the Olympics. Have you been watching?
Yeah, I'm definitely a sports junkie, so when things like World Cup, Euros, and Olympics are on, I can't stop. But the challenge that we were talking about is the time change. So generally speaking, by the time we've woken up, they've already played like the day's events. So we're just watching like highlights and replays and stuff, which can be an efficient way to watch the thing. You can just see like the finals and stuff.
Yeah.
But my big sports for the Olympics is I like the classic ones. I like the swimming and I like the track and field. Those are my things.
I agree. I'm swimming and rowing. Those are the two ones that I'm interested in, but yeah, I mean, I don't stay up to watch like the live Olympics, possibly if it is in the middle of the night, because I have a newborn and I have a life and other things. But I mean, highlights are okay. And sometimes when I turn it on, it's okay as well. But we were talking right before we started recording that it's a strange Olympics because COVID is still in the back of our minds, and it's even affecting some of the athletes and some games as well. So it's an unusual Olympics, I think.
Yeah, it's quite surprising in the sense that we just watched the Euros a month ago and some of the stadiums, they were packed.
Yeah.
Like in Denmark and the UK and Hungary, I think they had full stadiums, like 50,000 people. And then here, opening ceremony,
zero.
Big things where you expect massive crowds, nobody around. So,
yeah. Has it been organized so far as an event? Like it's been pretty structurally like smooth, or what have you heard? Because like I would assume outside of COVID, the Japanese are very, very like, you know, on point, like on time, like very like very smooth transitionally. But now with COVID and everything like that, because I heard about people getting COVID, but I don't know if the games have been actually running smoothly or not.
I haven't heard any issues involved with that. I mean, the opening ceremony was a bit slow compared to previous ones I've seen. Maybe they had to make adjustments based on COVID distancing rules and whatnot. So aside from that, I think it's all going okay.
Yeah. And this is a controversial question, and I'm posing it to you. Which country do you support here? Because nationally, you're a Canadian, but second nationally, you're also a Brit, but you live in the Netherlands and your partner is Italian Swiss, right? So you got
five. Canada. It's all about Canada. Yeah.
It's cool.
I revert back to the original thing. So I'm a supporter of Canada at the Olympics and whenever they're involved in the World Cup, which is once a century. And
yeah. Yeah. I get that. That's cool. I was, I was talking with my wife. We were posing the same questions because, like, we're, I guess, she's a Canadian PR. I'm a citizen, but she's a Moroccan, and Morocco is in the Olympics as well, which is interesting. And then ethnically, I'm from Bangladesh. And interesting fact, Bangladesh has two athletes in the Olympics. They were
Oh.
chosen from there's like a round. You qualify for the Olympics, but there's also a couple positions that like you can re-qualify for. They kind of give them out. There's like a thing. So for swimming and archery, they qualified, so like, or
Like out of pity or something, right?
I don't think that's the wording that they use,
Okay.
but there is like an option to be more like diplomatic and like to be more global. So yeah, but I support Canada. But I was thinking, I was watching this documentary on the tennis player Naomi Osaka the other day, and I don't know if you know about her or not. I'm not really huge into tennis, but she's a Japanese-born American, and she gave up her American citizenship a long time ago just so she could compete for Japan when it came to things like this. So even though she lives in California and she's like one of the best in the world, and she got eliminated the other day or whatever, but she's an American who gave up her passport just for to be on the Japanese team.
Would you do something like that? Would you compete for Bangladesh if you had the wherewithal to compete?
I only hold one passport anyways, so I would just stay with Team Canada. But one of the problems with I find with Team Canada is, and I know people are gonna like that on me, I find we're a little too like in your face with our wear, with our clothing. Everything has Hudson's Bay Company written on it, which I hate. I mean, I like looking at the uniforms, and some of the uniforms are really nice. But us, we're just like, we're always promoting that one company, like with our uniform. So I would be like, listen, I'll support you. I will play for our team, but can we have a rethink on some of the uniforms here? Because
Yeah, it's almost always Roots or the Bay. And
roots
I'm
of the
like, is that the
game.
only thing we got?
It's the, yeah, I mean, I don't think we have to promote the company like that makes the like promote the country. But yeah, I would do, if I could in Summer Olympics, it would be if I could be a swimmer or a rower for Canada, that'd be amazing. And the Winter Olympics, if I could be a hockey player, it has all Canadian boys, that'd be amazing. But I'm nowhere close to that, and I've aged out, so I'm okay with my fate.
I was watching the swimming, and I kind of got back into swimming a little bit lately in the local pool here that I feel a bit more COVID safe.
Yeah,
But I
it's.
watched some of these Olympic swimmers, and what I can't figure out is their breathing, because they're going at such a pace and they're breathing pretty much every stroke.
Yeah.
And I'm like, they're barely getting their nostrils out of the water. I'd be like choking on everything and floundering about. But these
Yeah.
guys just go.
So like, I mean, so I told you this before. Growing up, I wanted to play hockey so badly, but my mom didn't want me to. It's too dangerous. So she put us in swimming. So we started swimming at a really young age, and we finished all. I don't know how it was in Ontario, but here we had like numbers and colors for the levels.
The
And
colors, yeah.
so we finished those. I did my lifeguarding. I did this. So like, I'm super comfortable in water and pools and stuff. So like, I competed a little bit. I wasn't great. But one of the things about swimming I realized was the more you do it, your lung capacity gets bigger and bigger, and so you're able to hold your breath for longer and longer. So even if you watch those swimmers, sometimes some of these guys don't really actually need to take breaths if the distance is not long. On a 50 meter, I think you don't really need to take that many breaths. Like, you know how we learned one, two, three, right?
Three, go. One, two, three. Yeah, I think Olympic pool is 50 meters, right? So you're right. I think I watched one where it was the relay, and one of the like final it was the men's, one of the final guys in the pool, in his like first jump in,
The
he
halfway
essentially
line.
did the first 50 meters with maybe one breath.
These guys train a lot, and they're like, they take their like O2 oxygen levels, and they have huge lung capacities. They did a like a I know Phelps is no longer in the Olympics. He doesn't swim, he's retired, but they did like a body analysis of Phelps, and they realized his body was like perfectly made for swimming, like in terms of like wingspan, capacity, height, the way his body is built, his shoulders. And remember, these guys have been like training every day for the last like 100 years doing this and stuff. So they're like, I'm sure they're more uncomfortable out of the pool than they are in the pool. They just understand water. And like you said, once they dive in, like they're underwater for like half the length of the pool. Then they come up, and then they're just like a torpedo and stuff. So it's crazy, man. Like, these athletes really are built in an amazing way.
Yeah, it's super impressive and super respectable.
Very super respectful. Anyways, it's your week to present. Please,
Yes.
hopefully you have something.
So on the topic of Japan, not quite Olympics. That's the best segue I can come up with. I want to talk business.
Ooh,
So
interesting.
it's a I'm going to talk about a businessman who you may have heard of. He's not really like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos famous, but he's fairly well known. His name is Carlos Ghosn. Have you heard of him?
Carlos Gold?
Ghosn.
Oh, Ghosn.
Ghosn. I hope
Oh.
I'm pronouncing it right because his last name is spelled Ghosn, but they say Ghosn.
Okay, sure. I've never heard of him before.
Yeah. So he was the former CEO of Renault,
Okay.
of Nissan, and chairman of Mitsubishi. So he was very powerful executive for these big car companies. And
Oh.
for a period of time, he was like the god of the automotive industry because he was like presiding over all these companies.
Not at the same time, like subsequently, right?
Yes, he was wearing multiple hats. At the same time, he was CEO of Renault, CEO of Nissan, and chair of
Is that
Mitsubishi Motors.
were they all
Because
over?
Mitsubishi is a massive conglomerate, so he was head of the
Oh.
Mitsubishi. Still, it's crazy because Renault
Wait.
is this big French company, Nissan a big Japanese company. He's flying back and forth trying to like run these two companies.
Gosh.
So he was like considered like the superpowered executive,
Yeah.
and it all came crashing down. So I want to kind of tell the story about his rise and fall and his great escape from justice.
Okay.
So
Love it.
it's a very interesting story. It's still kind of a developing one in some sense, but we'll get to that. So I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing it right. Carlos Ghosn.
Going, okay.
He is of Lebanese descent, but he was born in Brazil. So speaking of cosmopolitan, he's a very, very cosmopolitan guy. Lebanese heritage, born in Brazil, studied engineering at the fancy Grande École school in France. And he speaks French, English, Arabic, Portuguese as a result of his upbringing.
Okay.
And he's a citizen of three countries, so Brazil, Lebanon, France. Very cosmopolitan.
Very cool.
He does very well in school and he goes to these very prestigious universities, which are pretty much like the golden ticket, the equivalent of like going to Oxford in the UK or Harvard in the US. So he took a job out of university for a little tie-in to a previous podcast episode, Michelin.
Okay.
Except for this, he didn't work for the restaurant wing of Michelin. He worked for the actual tire company,
Okay.
which is, I guess, the core of the business. So he was at Michelin for quite some time. He was there for like, I think it was 18 years. I could be wrong, but who cares? And he was very successful there. He was a specialist at like turnaround. So the troubled parts of the business, they'd send him in and he would like cut costs and close factories and merge things. And then they'd become profitable and he kind of moved his way up the corporate ladder. And he like gained attention from other French companies. So he caught the attention of Renault in 1996, where he joined. And he was, I think, put in charge of like their Latin America division. And again, he managed to like turn around the Renault division there. And the French media, as a result of his success with these two French companies, they called him Le Cost Killer.
Yeah, cost killer.
Le Cost Killer, oui.
Okay.
And so he kept on rising and rising because of his success in turning around troubled businesses. And at the time, Renault had acquired a stake in Nissan,
Oh.
the very large Japanese car company.
Cool.
And Nissan was struggling. And this was perfectly primed for someone like Carlos.
Yeah.
Nissan was massively struggling. It was $35 billion in debt. That's horrible.
That's
I
crazy.
can't even fathom that kind of debt. Like countries have that kind of debt, not companies. But there you go. Mr. Le Cost Killer was sent in to Nissan to try and fix it up after Renault took a stake in the company.
Yeah.
And again, he worked his magic And he managed to improve the company by firing loads of workers, laying off loads of workers, and closing factories. And the company actually returned to profitability, and it actually overtook a Honda to become Japan's number two car company.
Cool.
So, as a result of this success, he became a kind of a minor celebrity in Japan. He was like adored. It's kind of a rare thing in Japan to have international foreign CEOs. So that's kind of what made him stand out too. And so like he had manga cartoons drawn about him. He had all sorts of, he was interviewed and in the media all the time. He became very famous. So continuing his rise, he became CEO of Renault in 2005. So at that point, he kind of like presided, I think, over an alliance between the two companies. So it wasn't like a formal merger, but like each had a stake in the other, but didn't merge. So it wasn't like 50-50 or one bought the other. It was kind of a weird, complicated ownership structure. And then he became, so he was then CEO of Renault and Nissan. And so as we discussed, he was flying back and forth. Like every month, he was like 1 week in France, 1 week in Japan. On it, he was racking up like so many air miles. I guess someone like him probably doesn't care about air miles. He's getting paid millions of dollars. Not a big problem, right?
Probably flying private jet or something.
He had his private jet. Yeah,
just
yeah.
point
So,
on a private jet.
No air miles there actually. So yeah, then in 2016, as if being CEO of these two companies wasn't enough, Nissan took a stake in Mitsubishi. So the motor vehicle division of Mitsubishi, because as you know,
To make other
Japan has these gigantic companies which own all sorts of different things and run different products, Mitsubishi being one of them. So he became chairman of Mitsubishi Motors, and then he was running essentially three companies at once. And that's when he started to like stretch himself a little bit thin, as you would imagine. I mean, yeah, I don't even understand how anyone human could manage that. We talked about Elon Musk, and again in a previous episode,
Crazy.
he was running three or four companies at one time, right?
Yeah, of course.
But in one country, in the United States. And it's a big country, but still a little more manageable. It's, you know, they speak English, but he was having to go between the Japanese working culture, French working culture, trying to balance all these things.
Imagine.
And yeah, so everything was going well, or so he thought. And at one point in November 2018, he was landing back in his private jet landed in Tokyo. And he was actually arrested at the airport. So he didn't even get a chance to disembark, as far as I understand. Agents like boarded his private plane and placed him under arrest. And it was kind of a weird, convoluted, complex charge that he was held for. It was for allegedly underreporting his compensation while at Nissan. So they were saying, apparently Nissan had it in for him. This is what his allegations were towards the company, and they had already begun like investigating him. They had like monitored his emails and stuff, and they said you like misappropriated or like paid yourself like millions of dollars more than we wanted to pay you somehow. And they were saying like you took the private jet for on holidays, you did all sorts of things that, you know, you should just do company business with it. Another example, he said allegations of improper spending. And this included an $800,000 Marie Antoinette themed party at the Palace of Versailles. Have you been to Versailles?
No, but I know of it and what it is.
Yeah, it's just a completely crazy, massive palace. And he also threw his own wedding at Versailles. Allegedly using company funds. By the way, the Marie Antoinette theme party was ostensibly to celebrate like some anniversary of Nissan. It just so happened to fall on his 60th birthday.
Awesome.
So people were saying, well, that was just for your birthday.
Yeah.
And then the other aspect to this was that the Nissan executives, they're a bit concerned about like Carlos's plan to they kind of figured that he was going to try and eventually merge all these companies under one, and he would preside over this unified structure. And they didn't like that because, you know, these are very proud Japanese companies with lots of history.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't want to see Nissan fall into French hands, just like the French wouldn't want Renault to fall into Japanese hands. So part of the conspiracy thinking is that, you know, they took this action to try to stop him and slow him down, and he'd like gone too far.
Yeah.
Another angle that people say is that he kind of upset the business community in Japan because he had an extremely high salary compared to other automotive executives in Japan. So I looked it up. His salary was like three times higher than the next highest paid person. So like Toyota, Honda, Suzuki executives.
Yeah.
He was getting paid, I forget, in yen, it's like 1.5. 2 billion yen, but I don't know what that is in dollars. But
crazy.
The Toyota CEO is earning like 400,000 yen or something. So he was kind of ruffling feathers there. So there's all these kind of backstories to why he may have been arrested in Japan. Anyways, this is where it gets kind of crazy. So he is then jailed in Japan. And he was held for 108 days in essentially solitary confinement. He was stripped of his watch, his phone, his computer. Like, just think of this guy. He's this massively high-powered executive, used to, like, getting whatever he wants, flying wherever he wants, doing whatever he wants, whatever he wants.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, he's, like, stripped of everything and, like, in prison. And, he's going to really totally change circumstance. Like, his family's not there. He's in Japan away from everything.
Yeah.
Apparently, he was questioned without his lawyer around. Eventually, he was released on bail, but he was kind of essentially on house arrest within Japan. So he was allowed to just move around Japan, but he was under 24-hour surveillance. So there was like at least one to three or four people tailing him at all times whenever he left his house.
Yeah.
And he was only allowed to use the internet like under strict supervision from someone. So his communications were monitored.
Like mom and dad?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And apparently under the charges he was facing, he could face up to 15 years in jail. And he was like 65 years old, I think, at the time. So not exactly a great thing to do in your later years.
Yeah.
And he was citing Japan's really strong conviction rates. I didn't like cross-check this, but he was saying Japan has a conviction rate of like 99%, which sounds like something you'd get in North Korea.
Yeah.
But he's like, well, I'm essentially going to go to jail forever. And there's no hope for me.
Yeah.
So he was like thinking I'm doomed. So he escaped.
Yeah. This is where
Have you heard the story?
You told me his name. I didn't get it. But when I started Wikipedia, I remember hearing something about this happened just like really recently, right?
It happened in 2019 at Christmas time or just at end of December.
Yeah.
So yeah, end of December 2019, he managed to escape Japan, which is really baffling because of the surveillance he was under, his limited communications, all sorts of factors. Like, how is this possible? Yeah. And he's a very well-known person in Japan. Like, he's a minor celebrity. And he looks very distinctive. If you look him up, he's kind of has these like Mr. Bean look to him. He's very distinctive eyebrows. So it'd be kind of hard to mistake him in a crowd.
Yeah, and he's not Japanese himself, right? So he's
and not Japanese. And Japan's not exactly the most multicultural.
Well, there's a homogeneous physicality to the Japanese people. Yeah, I mean, I think there are people there are a lot of foreigners there. But I think like when you can definitely distinguish the non-foreigners from the you can definitely distinguish the outsiders from the locals very easily just because of the difference in the numbers. For sure.
Okay. So let's get into I'll try my best. let's get into the details about his escape. It's quite amazing.
I love it.
So it's not quite clear. I mean, I watched an interview. It was a BBC interview with Carlos, and they're asking him specific questions like, how did you do it?
You mean
how is it possible?
He gave an interview post-escape?
Yeah. So he's been doing lots of media afterwards to kind of
clear his name,
build his profile and clear his name and whatnot.
Okay. How do you
But the BBC one is very like specific. They're like, how did you do it? You had no communications. And he kind of brushed it off and didn't specify. Anyways, so he somehow managed to like build a team of ex-police, ex-military, who are helping like investigate scenarios for him to escape the country because he was convinced that he was going to be in jail forever. So apparently the guy who was running this team was an American guy named Michael Taylor, ex-US Special Forces, he's from the Green Berets or whatever it's called. And he previously served apparently in Lebanon, the Lebanese, in the Civil War. I guess, you know, the US had a deployment there at that time.
Yeah.
And there's possibly some connections from Carlos's Lebanese family or whatnot. I don't know.
That was the destination. That was the final destination he wanted to get to, right?
So, yeah, I'll come to that because final destination was indeed Lebanon for a very important reason. So basically, they were scouting out ways for him to, like, flaws in the surveillance and cracks in the system for him to, like, get out. And what they discovered was that, so they figured this was impossible. They would try it anyways because they figured this guy's going to go to jail, so we need to find a way. And it was like,
Hail Mary.
Let's go, Hail Mary. So they found a flaw, and the flaw was that whenever Carlos was going into a hotel for a meeting, because he could still move around Japan, but he'd just be followed, the surveillance team wouldn't follow him into the hotel. They would stand back, and they would kind of like watch him from there, or I don't know, wait for him to come out.
Interesting.
And so they found a hotel in Tokyo, which had many exits and entrances and a strange architecture. It wasn't too easy to like look into. And that was the Grand Hyatt in Tokyo.
Uh-oh. Okay.
So basically, all he did when he fled the country, he just walked outside of his house in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And he had a surgical COVID mask on, as we all do these days.
Yeah.
And, I guess in pre-COVID, it's fairly common in Japan to wear a mask anyway. So it wasn't totally unusual.
Sure.
It's pretty common from what I could make out to have that there. And so he went to the Grand Hyatt, but then he lost his surveillance team in there, and he left from a different exit, and the surveillance team, it worked. And from there, he was heavily disguised. He wasn't just like wearing the surgical mask. He had different clothes on. Everything was different, possibly covering up his very distinctive eyebrows, maybe a hat over. And he went to Shinagawa Station. It was a very busy station in Tokyo, and took a bullet train to Osaka Airport.
Wow. And he had like a...
And that part must have been freaky for him. I don't know if at that point he was concealed in something, because to just go in the open from Tokyo to one big city to another, it would be quite high risk.
By himself?
I think by himself. I that part is not clear.
Yeah.
But so the point at which so the way he concealed himself, like how did he get out of the country, is that his security team put him in a musical box. You know, when there's a big concert, you see the roadies pushing these huge things of these black boxes where they put the instruments in and stuff.
Yeah.
They stuck Carlos in that.
Okay.
So it's a specially designed thing with air holes in it and could fit him and everything. And that's how he managed to escape security or not go through an X-ray or something.
Okay.
Because he would fly private and they go through separate entrances and they'd be like, sorry, this thing is too whatever. And I don't know, the part that's not clear again, wouldn't security still like, can you open this at least and we can look through? It seems very, very lax.
Yeah.
But I guess when you're VIP or private, they get special treatment.
Okay, sure. So he's like Bon Jovi's roadie or whatever, something like that, right?
Yeah, so he said in a BBC interview, he was in this box for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And he said that at that point, like he was perfectly willing, you know, if he was caught in Japan doing that, you know, you're caught red-handed, you're going to be going to jail for a long time, he's done for. And at that point he's like, well, I did my choice. Because up at that point, if he was just wearing a mask and he went out the exit, it's not necessarily bad.
Yeah,
but to be caught in a musical box in an airport, you're done for, you're trying to escape the country. But it worked. He got on the private jet and they flew him to Istanbul.
This part I remember.
Because it would be too obvious to fly direct to Lebanon, because by that point, I assume the security surveillance is trying to track him down and they're looking for flights that are going from Japan to Lebanon. So they flew to Istanbul instead, to lose the tail, and change planes. And from there, he flew to Beirut.
Yeah.
And that's where he is now. And Beirut is great for a number of reasons. He has citizenship there. That's where he has, you know, family and his heritage and connections. And they have no extradition treaty with Japan.
Yeah.
So he's essentially, in some ways, like a prisoner in the country. And, you know, have you been to Lebanon?
I have not. You?
It's like, no. It's a small country, right? Geographically, very small. It's very economically challenged these days. And for someone who's like a globe-trotting CEO, he's probably feeling a little bit tense there. Either way, he's still he's a free man. So that's the main thing.
Yeah.
And he just was convinced that he wouldn't get a fair trial in Japan. And that's his main reason for escaping. And as it stands now, there's the Interpol red notice, warrant for his arrest that Japan has issued. So if he starts traveling to places where there's an extradition treaty with Japan, he can be sent back and then he'll go to jail.
Yeah.
So right now he's in Lebanon and he's like giving speeches and he's apparently teaching university classes and doing all sorts, lots of media to kind of clear his name. But from what I understand, his security team, they're American. And they actually got, in the U.S., the ex-U.S. Secret Service or Special Forces dudes, they got extradited to Japan. So they're going to go to jail probably.
Because Japan and U.S. have
extradition. Because they have extradition treaties. Oh. So he got out of this okay. Apparently there's also another Nissan executive from the U.K. or U.S. who was arrested at the time that he was arrested. Yeah. Didn't escape. Like Carlos was like, see you later, I'm out of here. And he's still in jail.
Crazy.
So he's there. And his wife is also subject to charges. And she's an American citizen, so is much more vulnerable. So Carlos is really the one who's like got away and is like most legally sound in the situation. But his escape team is in trouble. His partner is in trouble and his business partner is in jail.
Oh my
God. But Carlos is all right.
That's crazy. It's like a movie. It's like a, but okay. Obviously he's not running these three companies anymore. Right. I mean, they've reassigned stuff like that. So is there truth? So pretty much, I mean, the way I didn't know the story until you told me, but it seems like it's like corruption and mismanagement of funds, right? Is that pretty much what?
Yeah. I mean,
he was paying himself.
It's a tough one. I mean, there's a bit of the Icarus story where he kind of got very powerful and maybe it went to his head a little bit and he felt entitled to these things and pay me lots of money and take the private jet here. I need to like go do these things with my family and I'm bringing so much shareholder value. But so people, I guess, are willing to accept that to a point, but he kind of pushed it beyond that point and alienated people.
Yeah. I mean, when you have a Lebanese guy who runs a Japanese company having a Marie Antoinette party in France for $800,000.
It's just bad optics, right? You got to be a bit humble.
Yeah. It looks, especially since Japanese people, I think in themselves are very, very humble as well. They're not big show offy people, as you pointed to with salaries of counterparts, right? It's like, I think there was like a culture, but like, don't a lot of these companies have boards and like people who would be balancing and checking all this stuff, or did Carlos have all this power that he was able to do things without
I think there's a lot of like different examples of this in the business world and in politics or in various parts of life where someone becomes this big powerful figure, like larger than life, and people for the longest time will just not question it, right? And until something kind of goes wrong or there's like a moment where it just flips and then they lose their credibility.
And I think one thing I've also noticed, I don't know if you've also, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I noticed as well as like we've both lived in other places around the world. And I think like in some societies, such as Japanese society, which is very like respectful and disciplined, and there's like a hierarchy and a respect to others, like they must have seen Carlos as a foreigner who's come and running this company. So there's that, like, you know, we're almost inferior to him, so we can't really approach him and like, you know, ask or question him. Whereas in our country, you know, people are like, just vicious with each other. There's like at least like that respect. And so maybe Carlos manipulated that a little bit or used it against.
Yeah. And Japan has very much the tradition of the company man. So yeah. Like a lot of these people probably started with Toyota or Honda and worked their way up to become CEO. So it's a very, I think, old school, if you like, way of doing climbing the corporate ladder. Like you really try and get this good corporate job and you stick with it and you work like crazy at the job forever. Yeah. Whereas he was like kind of transplanted in there and there's probably some resentment there. Mm-hmm. And then, just the whole like outsider thing. I think he maybe had this outsider feeling when you're, I mean, I had it too. And you felt the same when you're in like doing business in Malaysia or Turkey. And I was working in Hungary and here in the Netherlands. You can go far and do business. You always feel a little bit like detached or outside of what's going on. And maybe that gives you like a sense of a chip on your shoulder where you have something to prove. Or maybe like on the other side, if you become like successful, either you become like a local story or people just hate you and resent you.
I think in Carlos's case, it seems as though like, just like that Icarus metaphor you used, the more, you know, he did well with Renault and then Nissan and then Mitsubishi, I think the power started really getting to his head. I think at one point you feel like, listen, I'm doing so much for these companies. And like, I deserve this Marianne.
It's the I deserve thing, which is the problem, I deserve this.
That's a very, but like, I mean, you and I know, both being coming from business worlds and doing like, this is a very common tale. Like it's a tale as old as time in the business world. In 2008, when the financial crisis happened, we got to see an inside look at all those banks and they were doing the same thing, right? They were like, going to Florida, throw these like lavish weekends and shareholder meetings and like $80 orange juices and like this and that, and it's not on their dime at all, right? So they have no like repercussions or no double thinking because it's not their money, right? And then people just kind of feel like, I deserve to do this because I'm making people this and that. So like, I don't know the actual finances, but it's interesting that the Japanese government or the Japanese police kind of picked up on this, right? Or were informed about this. So like the minute he landed, because I'm really interested to see what his lawyers, how they argued against it, right? Or tried to argue against it. Like they'd be like, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of, like you said, it highlights the importance of good governance and how people who are like able to challenge someone who's like so powerful.
Yeah.
But it becomes so, I can see how it's a problem. Like when there's someone who's so successful and so, you know, famous, it can be so intimidating to be the person to put your hand up and say,
no.
Yeah. And then the whole room will turn against you and say like, you can feel so alone and that guy can be so powerful to like crowd you out.
Exactly.
So like
your head, yeah, you know?
I'm Marie Antoinette stuff, right? So
nice tie around.
Exactly. I mean, that was such bad optics, this Marie Antoinette thing. But anyways, like I can just imagine yourself being in like a boardroom with this guy and he's saying, this is my vision, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And everyone kind of nodding and agreeing.
Yeah.
But if you like take a step back and think, wait a minute, would I normally like let someone do this? Well, he's got to be right because he did these things and let's give it to him.
Yeah.
But clearly, I think you any normal person should think running, being CEO of two companies at the same time is a challenge, let alone two companies in different countries.
So
that's pretty much.
My follow-up question is that while he was CEO of these companies, did all of them do well? Or like, was he able to actually manage all three or two? Sorry.
They were doing okay, I think.
Yeah.
I think around 2017, 18, the share prices started to go down. Yeah. And I don't know if it's like when he got arrested, that was when everything went bad and it is because of him, or it was on the way down beforehand. Yeah. And then that's when they decided to pull the trigger.
Well,
I'm not sure. Yeah.
One thing for sure is that these companies, and I would guess all automotive companies will probably never make the same mistake again, like ever in the history of automotives.
Will have a picture of him on the wall as a lesson, you know, don't try and get carried away by these famous faces.
The most interesting thing I want to get to is his escape. Because while you were going through it, I always think about stuff like this. I'm like, how would you escape this? Just for fun and stuff like that. So the fact that he had, like, he was under house arrest, but he still had access or resources to get, like, special military people. This, that doesn't surprise me at all. Like people, he probably had like a stack of cash somewhere that nobody knew about, right? Like he probably had access to money like that the government, because they probably froze his public accounts or the ones that they knew about, but he probably, rich people have money everywhere in the world. And like, you know, not everyone knows. So that's not an issue at all. But like how he escaped was interesting too, because couldn't it have been done in other ways? Like, couldn't it also have been like that hotel thing, that little loophole is interesting to me, right? Because like you could go into any building and like exit through another entrance and they wouldn't know, right? Like why?
Yeah, and it seems like a massive flaw in the surveillance team. Totally. Because clearly that departure point wasn't the first one. He had done a lot of preparation meetings with these people to be like, okay, on the day, this is what we do. He would get briefings on the plan.
Yeah.
So he knew exactly what to do and when and how.
Yeah.
Like for each step of the way.
Yeah.
How would that not get picked up on? I just don't see it.
That's well, strange. If I was his guy, like I don't know if this is possible or not, but like what if they like completely changed his disguise with like a mask or some type of like fingerprint? Like couldn't he just be a different dude that doesn't look like him and then like board a private jet and get out? Like did he have to like take a train to Osaka and hide in a music box and et cetera, et cetera? Like couldn't it have been like Mission Impossible style? Like, I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I guess he figured like going from Tokyo, when they lost him in Tokyo, they would just have to be the first place they would check.
Yeah.
So, well, I don't know. I would imagine like if he disappeared,
yeah,
the first thing I would check is all the private jets.
Totally.
In the country that are leaving, not the commercial airlines.
Yeah.
This guy doesn't fly commercial. He wouldn't leave the country on a KLM or Air Canada flight out of the country.
which by the way, if we were going to switch sides and think of his mentality, I would have been like, listen, take the Air Canada economy class seat next to the toilet. You know what I mean?
Like, I wonder, like, at what point, like, if he's on that flight and once it clears Japanese airspace, is he fine? Or no, like,
no, because because this happened, remember, a couple of years ago, a guy out of China who's actually 20 or 25, he dressed as an old man arriving into Vancouver. Do you remember the story?
No.
So he put on prosthetics and he cleared Chinese customs and immigration. He got in an Air Canada flight. I might be getting the airlines wrong. Midway through the flight, the guy next to him realized his hands didn't match his face in terms of skin tone.
Oh my God.
And stuff. And so he reported it to one of the things. And so they realized this guy had put on a mask of an old dude. I'll send you the article or whatever. When he arrived into YVR, he got arrested, right? And then he was, I don't know what happened afterwards, probably deported or whatnot. So I don't think it's like Argo style that like once you depart Japanese airspace, you're safe. I think you got to make it to your Istanbul and get on your next flight to be okay, right? And then once you're in like Lebanon or whatever, like, because then you could switch it up. Because by the time they realize you're out, the Japanese authorities would have informed Interpol or other international organizations, and there'd be like pretty much a warrant and he'd have to be very strategic. I mean, he knew that Lebanon and Japan had no extradition. So, I mean, that was something that like, you know, was probably...
I guess Turkey wouldn't be there, because if you land in Turkey and get sent back right away, then...
Especially, yeah, I think like a lot of these countries, you got to be strategic. I remember Omar al-Bashir, the ex-president of Sudan, when he was called up for the International Criminal Court, he was given a warrant for his arrest as well. But if he stick with certain countries, he didn't have to go. He wouldn't get extradited. So he stuck with those countries for years and years and years. And so, I mean, getting out, that private plane thing definitely would have been a red flag. But maybe he did it so quickly that like the Japanese didn't even figure it out, right? I mean, like, Tokyo.
He took a bullet train, so you know he's there. Tokyo, yeah. Osaka, no time.
That's like the snake. That's like the tail that bites the snake, or whatever. You're the hand that feeds.
Yeah, exactly.
The Japanese are too efficient.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it had to be right on cue, I guess. I've also heard, I don't know if this is true because I don't fly private, but I've heard that when you go through private, like you know, when you go to an airport and you go through private, the private terminals, it's much more relaxed than it is on commercial, like security, customs, immigration. So like, I mean, once he got to Osaka's airport and whatever it is, I'm sure they didn't give a shit. Like, I'm sorry, they didn't care too much about like the whole thing. They're probably, that's when the music, that music box thing you told me, it didn't surprise me. They're probably like, yeah, whatever. Like, you know? So like, but the private plane definitely is a red flag, because how many people take private planes, right? A small
handful. Yeah, but I guess, you know, Tokyo, Osaka has enough private jets probably going out of their airports. It's a rich country,
yeah.
Possibly. But again, I would be like, we lost this big dude who's super famous. Call HQ right away, boss. We lost him.
Totally.
And they would like, if he's so big that they would send out an Interpol red notice for his arrest.
Immediately.
Wouldn't that like immediately put a blanket warning at airports?
Trains. Yeah.
Because it's Japan. You can't swim out of the ocean. You can't take like a, I don't know, a rowboat out of there. It's gonna be a plane.
And physically, he's distinguishable from the local population, right? Like in the fact that he's So he's a sore thumb, right? Like you could definitely point him out a little bit, but I don't know. I would have maybe boat would have been better, you know, at least to get to the next country or some other form of or to get hidden in the country somewhere. But yeah, I don't know, man. Like, I mean, this is some guy's job was to think of how to get him out, and they did it.
It's just incredible. You know, just imagine this—the change of being this high-powered executive to having to go into a box for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It must have been very humbling for him. But from what he said in the interview, he said it was a risk I was willing to take. I wasn't willing to face the prospect of jail for the rest of his life, or you know, his later years.
Yeah.
So he just decided to like do the Hail Mary.
It's crazy that things like this can still happen in like 2021 in the world, right?
Like, it's definitely something out of a movie, right?
It's craziness. And then like he's on a plane, and then like, you know, the plane's in like air in the air, and they're like just panicking, like, have we cleared Japanese airspace? Are we entering? Japan's a small country, relatively speaking, to other countries. So, and it's right by the water. So like, I'm sure you're out of Japanese airspace in like 10 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, China and Japan, they don't have good relationships. So, you know, by the time the Japanese tell the Chinese don't care. And
they're like, sorry, wrong number.
Yeah. Wrong number. They don't even answer. It's one of those like messages.
Yeah.
And then like once you land in Turkey, like, you know, the Turkish don't care too. And then like once you get to Lebanon, it's like home free. But like he can never, like when he travels now, he'll have to be very strategic of where he goes and what he does, right? And like and stuff. But like that's, but one of the things is like, so his team have been extradited to Japan, right? And I'm surprised that the American happened. Like the American government was like, yeah, okay, you know, is there?
It's pretty unusual, I would imagine, for U.S. citizens to get extradited. But
yeah,
I don't know. I guess in the interests of U.S.-Japan relations, maybe it's because it's an ally. You know, Japan's a strong ally of the U.S., so they are more willing to do so. Whereas if like China wanted to extradite or take a U.S. citizen, that would be a huge diplomatic no-no.
Yeah.
You know, put Iran, all the enemies of the great Satan.
Yeah, is somewhere.
But it is an interesting point about U.S. citizens having extraditions, but I don't know.
I have no problem or questions regarding his financial wealth, because like I told you, rich people have money everywhere. I'm sure he's fine and he planned it. He probably lost a couple million in Japan here and there, but he has his life and his freedom. But like, how will the rest of his life play out? Will be like, he'll always have to be looking over his shoulder, right? Until something happens. Because like,
he said he's willing to stand trial in the countries of his citizenship or anywhere where he thinks he can get a fair trial. But he says he doesn't think it's Japan.
Really? I would have thought Japan very diplomatic, like a very just place for trial, but 99% conviction rate is pretty high. Like, I don't know, that seems kind of sketchy though.
I guess there's not much crime there, so whenever there is something, it's got to be like a pretty open and shut case. I don't know
from a judicial point of view, maybe like they've developed, I honestly don't know, but maybe the Japanese criminal justice system is not, it's not that it's corrupt or it's been destroyed anyway, but maybe you're right, maybe like they have a good handle on crime. So when they do take you to trial, it's pretty much like
they know it's for something. Yeah, like
maybe, you know, because like, what are the countries of his citizenship? Lebanon, France, and
Brazil.
And Brazil. So like, if you had to choose between Lebanon, France, Brazil, and Japan, I mean, Brazil and Lebanon for sure are out in terms of me. Like, I would never want to choose that. Like, no offense. So France or Japan, right? Like, I don't know, man. The French, I mean, I know it's a good system and stuff, but Japan, I would put it probably equally, right? One of those two countries. But France is pretty much the one he has left over. And France is like a Western country. I'm pretty sure they have extradition. They're part of the EU with other places in the world too. So pretty much I'm assuming he'll probably never leave Lebanon. Like, I'm sure that's home forever.
Yeah, but I don't think we've seen the last of Mr. Ghosn. I think he's too ambitious and too...
He can't...
He can't sit still. I think he's had such power and he's tasted power. That he's going to find a way back and have his moment in the sun again.
Yeah.
So watch this space is what I think.
That's a crazy, crazy story.
I would, like, generally speaking, I know this won't happen, but I would think, like, you've just pulled off this incredible escape.
Yeah.
Just chill out in Lebanon, enjoy your life, live the high life in Lebanon as best you can.
Yeah.
But don't try and do anything else ever again. Just retire and enjoy your money.
Yeah.
But I bet you he won't.
Yeah.
I bet you he won't.
And he'll use some, like, a public PR system to, like, clear his name. I need to clear it. I need to be like that, you know, be on good terms with the world and stuff like that. But yeah, like, that's great. He could come to some kind of a recompensation agreement with the companies in Japan and et cetera, et cetera. So at least he could clear the financial aspect, like pay back the Marie Antoinette for a party. Right, like in the 80s, plus interest, plus a fee for stupidity, and like how bad it looked, but yeah, that's crazy. I knew of when you told me the name, I was like, what? And then when I googled, I was like, oh yeah, this dude, right? Like, this guy.
Do you recognize him?
I recognize the fact. I remember the fleece story, like the getting away.
Okay.
But I didn't know how he did it. I didn't know. I was in Turkey at the time, so I remember it came up on the news locally. I didn't know how it ended and stuff, but this is sort of common to some of the other dictators and politicians and like former like world leaders who kind of run away or escape. I'm thinking about who's the guy, the Egyptian guy, Hosni Mubarak, right?
Yeah.
Who was kind of shunned to like a beach city or a beach town and like stuff. But I always find these guys, man, like they do some of the worst things and stuff, but they never really face the worst penalties. They just are like, oh, let's put him in a resort or let's like send him back to his home country or let's like give him a bunch of money. And like, do you remember a couple of years ago when the MBS became, he like kind of rose in power and he started arresting all his uncles and like locals and like all this.
He put them in the that was also the Hyatt, Ritz-Carlton. Yeah.
And I remember they did this like this film, this like tour of like these guys' suites, and it was like bigger than my house. Like, they're so big and they're drinking like high class like drinks and like non-alcoholic, of course, right? And then Heinz and these like champagne bottles, like Heinz ketchup and these like fancy little bottles, and like at the end these guys just have to pay to get out, right? They have to give like half their wealth up or whatever to the country to get out, and it's like, it must suck. But in Japan, it's such a democratic country, but this guy, he clearly did something, he misused it. So I don't know, I mean, we have to get a Japanese perspective on it, but they must have been building a case on him for like a long time, right? Like,
yeah, there's so many angles to this, which I want to know more about. And that's the other one, is like, he being such a high powered CEO at the time,
totally.
And his own company was essentially investigating him. Wouldn't he have someone like on the inside, like he's at least a friend, an ally, to like give him a heads up that something may be going on? So possibly that happened, and that's why he already had the wheels in motion for like the
backup
security
plan.
Team and the backup plan ready to go.
Yeah.
Especially
with.
But yeah, I found that surprising.
You make such a good, if you're CEO, you're pretty much like, you know, the major things that are happening in your company, right? And so like.
They say it's lonely at the top, so maybe you don't. Maybe everyone's out to get you.
Yeah. What do you know anything about this other guy, this business partner who's also been charged? Like.
No, I don't. I just know that he's another foreigner, and he's still in jail. I think maybe awaiting
trial. Yeah,
quite a long time to wait for a trial. So yeah, similar charges from what I understand.
I bet you once this guy escaped, they pretty much chained that other guy to the floor. Like,
yeah, you're not going anywhere. Yeah,
no bail.
But they asked Carlos, like, don't you feel bad? Like, you get managed to escape, but you have all this collateral damage. Like, if your team is getting sent to Japan, your ex-colleagues there, your wife is in trouble. And he kind of just said, well, I want to clear my name. It's not right for me, blah, blah, blah. So
you think this guy's going to throw his own wife under the bus, like, just to clear his name?
I cannot comment on such a thing in a public forum.
Yeah, it's the greed. I don't know why people, like, I think this is, when it comes to business and corporations and like, so, especially like these big corporations, this story is so common. Once people get up there, they become new other people, huh?
Yeah, it just goes to their head. It must be kind of a fun feeling for a while to be like, I'm a king of the world.
As with all things, kingdoms fall, tyrants fall, dictatorships fall. But yeah, nothing good, nothing good stays, you know. Well, I wouldn't say it's good, but like nothing too good stays, you know. Interesting day.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be like, there's always a happy medium, but it never works out that way where like you recognize you're doing well for yourself.
Yeah.
And like you can enjoy your life.
Yeah.
But they people, these people always want to have that one more little surprise, one more little party and step up, which gets them in trouble.
There's this, there's a quote from Gandhi, and I'm sort of butchering it, but pretty much he says for the long, throughout history, there's always been dictators and tyrants. And for the longest time, it looks as though they always succeed, but in the end they fall, they always fall. So it's sort of like the story of life is that these people get up there, but in the end, just this, there's a natural order to things. And then they screw it up most of the time for themselves, right?
Like, so. Yeah, that's why like I hardly read fiction, because you can find so many stories like this about real life craziness. So yeah, so that's the story. I'll share some of the interviews with him. It's very interesting to hear his side of the story.
Yeah,
and I hope you people found it interesting to hear the tale of a great escape.
The greatest. Ah, I like that. That's a good title for us. Carlos Ghosn, Great Escape. Thanks, Dave. I think that's it's an amazing topic. It's very interesting. Hopefully people can comment. Let us know what they think.
Absolutely. We'd like to hear from you.
Anyways, Dave, have a great day. Have a great week. Have a great month. Have a great year.
Have a great life.
Ciao.
Bye.